Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Wonders of the Night Sky, You Must See Before You Die by Bob King, Astro Bob. And I'm up to chapter 30. And look, I must admit, just reading it is very good for me because I'm trying to write a paper, so it's quite good. And this is the odd story, and you know, he sort of programs the actual action into your head, so I quite like him. So this is page number 30, The Ring Nebula. I recall a summer night years ago with a telescope set up on the driveway. As I poked around the night sky, my younger daughter Maria stepped out of the house. "What are you looking at?" She asked. "The Ring Nebula," I answered. "Want to see it?" She climbed up in a wobbly stepladder and looked at the eyepiece and saw nothing less than the end of the sun as we know it. Like Saturn, the Ring Nebula is a marvellous at first sight. It's easy to find midway between two bottom stars to the outline of the heart of the constellation Lyra. The ring looks like a smoke ring. A soft nebulous light floats in a field of stars. You can put your finger, put it on your finger, but it doesn't fit nicely in the eye. Okay. The ring shape is a crisp outline embedded, outline reminded an earlier generation of astronomers of a planet, and hence the designation as planetary nebula. The name is M57, the 57th entry in a catalogue of 110 deep sky objects compiled by the 18th century French comet hunter Charles Messner. So Messner, I think M31 is Andromeda, so that's interesting. It's only 110 objects. During his nightly comet quests, he'd occasionally run across fuzzy objects, nebula, galaxies, stars and clusters, that masqueraded as his favourite prey. Messner didn't have the benefit of current day maps, showing the positions of literally thousands of deep sky objects. So when he stumbled onto something fuzzy, he had to patiently observe the object or return it to another night to see it, see if it moved before deciding its nature. To avoid being waylaid by every fuzzy what is, Messner compiled a list of positions and a description of what he called embarrassing objects. On the morning of January 31st, 1779, while making observation of Bode's comet, Messner discovered what would come to be called the Ring Nebula with his small refracting telescope. Noted on Histoire de l'Académie Royale des Sciences, 1779, quote, "It's a very dim, with a very sharp boundary. It is as large as Jupiter and resembles a planet which is fading away." One of his contemporaries, Antoine Dacqueria, was searching for a comet with his 2.5-inch 63mm refracting telescope and stumbled across the Ring Nebula later that February. Here's his description from his letter to Messner, which appeared in the History de l'Académie Royale des Sciences. "A very dull nebula, but perfectly outlined, as large as Jupiter and looks like a fading planet." What? That's quite good. "Despite appearances, the ring has no relation to planets. The shell of gas is about a light year across and centered on a tiny, hot, super dense star called a white dwarf. The white dwarf is what's left after the Sun like star runs out of nuclear fuel. Deep in its core, under tremendous heat and pressure, the star fuses hydrogen and helium to make energy. Where hydrogen runs out and the core shrinks and heats up even more, igniting helium burns to form carbon and oxygen. During this brief phase of the star's life, the outer atmosphere balloons out to hundreds of times its current size, and the star becomes a red giant. When the sun swells to a giant about 5 billion years, astronomers believe that it will become large enough to engulf the Earth, Mercury, and Venus will be toast. Once the helium has been exhausted, when the sun swells to, once the helium fuel is exhausted, the nuclear fusion stops. but the core continues to collapse and heat up, ultimately becoming a white dwarf. A star with the mass of the Sun compacted in a sphere the size of the Earth, gusty winds blowing from the star, combined with the pressure of light streaming from the core, expels the outer gaseous envelope into space like a child blowing a bubble of powerful ultraviolet radiation from a dwarf, excites the expanding shell to glow. The planetary nebula is born. The Ring Nebulas made the transition some 20,000 years ago, when humans still hunted woolly mammoths. Well, yeah, I would grant that. Yeah, I would say that. Messner would kill to look through one of today's telescopes. The optics are sharper, and they gather more light for their size. So even a 3-inch scope magnification with 50 and higher will show the Ring Nebula as a puffball with light with a slightly darker center, the whole resembling a cosmic donut. The 6-inch 150mm telescope will show it's more oval than circular, and more clearly show the dark center. I've only ever seen the central white dwarf in an 11-inch, 128mm and larger telescopes on nights of excellent seeing. Then it appears as the tiniest flicker of light, hovering at the limit of vision. And when you look at the ring through the telescope, you'll walk a line separating the past from the future. In one direction, we join Messner in his moment of discovery. On a cold January morning more than 200 years ago. On the other, we see, like seers, to a time when the Sun will be transformed into an unrecognizable planet-sized star ringed by a shell of its former self. Beautifully written, isn't it? Pyrrhus, the double cluster. Well, God, this is actually a beautiful way that he's drawn it. It's just like a little man. It's a cowboy. That's only the US. Okay, Pyrrhus double cluster. Buy one bag of chips, get another one free. I always fall for that one. I come home and tell my family, hey, I got a great deal. Right, the sky's plenty of 2-for-1 specials. And the cost is always $0 unless you count mosquito bites and the occasional cold fingers. But even that can be avoided by choosing the night at the right time to sheer shop. Just when W. Cassavi appear, that's up in the northern hemisphere, not far from the Andromeda telescope galaxy, where the band of the Milky Way gets skinny, Pyrrhus, a hazy dot of the night, glows brighter than its surroundings. Although visible as a fuzzy patch with the naked eye, the outer suburbs and the countryside, a pair of 40mm or larger binoculars under moonless skies reveals not one, but two side-by-side star clusters rich in pinpoint suns. And in the northern hemisphere, sorry guys. Welcome to the double cluster of Pyrrhus. Two are aligned at approximately east-west in the sky and bear a catalogue numbers NGC 884 Eastern and NGC 869 Western. NGC stands for the New General Catalogue, a compendium of 7,840 galaxies. Nebula and star clusters are based on the original catalogue of nebula and clusters of stars created by his father, William Herschel, the 18th century astronomer who discovered the planet Uranus. The two clusters aren't line-of-sight happenstance. They're actually near one another in space, about 300 light-years apart, and reside in an enormous cloud of gas of young stars called the Pyrrhus OB1 Association, associated with the outer spiral line of the Milky Way galaxy, some 7,500 light-years from Earth. Take a minute to sweep the sky in the vicinity of the double cluster with binoculars, and you're sure to run across the starting knots and sprays where the Pyrrhus and Cassiopeia meet, and star clusters abound like candy tossed on a parade. Through a modest sized scope, the double cluster practically explodes with stars, a few which shine vividly red. I don't care how many times you see it, I guarantee you'll return every fall for another look. I never forget my first encounter with a double cluster as a 12-year-old. From my suburban Chicago neighborhood, through a 150mm refracting telescope. I was stunned by what seemed to be hundreds of stars. Several ruby ones add the extra pizzazz to the scene. While... groups of suns shaped like a smile at the centre of NGC 869 literally made me smile. What a tiny, beautiful asterism. So asteroid asterism is a group of stars which are shaped. Be sure to look for it. And if you think you need lots of magnifications to see things in the sky, these string clusters will prove you wrong. 30 to 70 can't be beat. Since that first experience, I make sure to drop in and look whenever Perseus stands high in the northeastern sky. Thanks to the cluster's relative proximity to the northern star, it's made visible from mid-August through to early April, where the north is possibly visible all the time. All star clusters are gravitationally bound collection of stars born from a nebula. Astronomically speaking, the twin clusters began life early, only 60 million years ago in NG 869 and 14 million in NG 884. The comparison of the sun's old fuddy-duddy, having recently celebrated its 5 billionth birthday, making it 500 times older. The dull cluster, loaded with freshly minted supergiant and giant stars that shine with fierce brilliance. That's why the Geo is so bright and easy to find. The same reason is that it's recorded for more than 2,100 years ago by the ancient Greek astronomer Hipparchus, the great globular in Hercules. Now, we've got the jewel box. This is another, I think it's another northern hemisphere. With the word great in its name, the cluster must really be something. Rest assured, you won't be disappointed. Also known as M13, after Mesnan, the 13th entry in Mesnan's catalogue, it's visible without optical aid on the moonless spring and summer nights. From the countryside, a small fuzzy patch. Even my old eyes can still spot the magnitude 5.8 smidge in the midst of the western side of Hercules' keystone asterism. The asterism means a shape that you just... that's the shape. So you can't talk constellation because it's defined. If fuzzy patch seems to describe so many objects in the heavens, I understand your skepticism. We can't help this. Almost everything in the universe is so far away. Most of it looks the same at the first blush. Remove stars to a great distance and they merge to a haze. That's why we use telescopes to expose the downy blobs for what they really are. Stunning star clusters, mind-bogglingly distant galaxies and colourful nebula. That's also why both amateur and professional astronomers desire even larger telescopes. Bigger scopes deliver more light and turn fuzzy black into suns. Let's hope my wife will appreciate this argument when it's time for that new telescope. Based on photographs taken by large instruments, the astronomers estimate that M13 packs some 300,000 stars into a roughly spherical volume of 145 light years wide. When viewed through a telescope, the stars appear stationary as if painted on a black canvas. But if we could speed up time so that every minute a million years pass, the cluster would populate with life. Its stars are moving randomly about and held together through an immense gravity of the whole. Cumulus are closely packed general spherical star clusters containing 10,000 up to a million stars. Yeah, so you have in the disk, the galactic disk, open clusters. That's their clusters are formed from nebula coming together, but above the disk you've got these spheres which are not gravitationally spread out and they're much older. But let's listen to what this has to say. The orbit of the central bulge of, sorry, goblins are densely packed spherical clusters containing up to a million stars. They orbit the central bulge of the Milky Way galaxy in a spherical halo thought to trace the limits of our galaxy in its use when it was the process of collapsing into smaller clouds of dust and gas. As the collapse proceeded, the Milky Way's rotation sped up. For the same reason, a skater pulling her arms faster, causing a newborn galaxy to whirl itself into a flattened disk we know today. Look, much more complicated than that. You've got to have conservation of angular momentum. And also, the galaxy has got all this dark matter, which means that the Jupiter doesn't spin as fast. If it was spinning according to it, it would just wind up. It's sort of like Jupiter. Oh, it's hard to describe. There's so many things going on. And the globules, they remain as border guards along the periphery of the great stellar empire. Because clusters formed early in the Milky Way's evolution, their stars are ancient, 10 billion years and older. When you look at M13, you're seeing a remnant of the birth of Milky Way before the Earth was even so much as a possibility. We know 150 globules in the Milky Way galaxies. Some galaxies have many more, roughly 12,000. Orbit M87 in Virgo, and more than 500 discovered in Andromeda. The Hercules cluster is one of the brightest and richest, and the reason you simply must see it. Binoculars begin to show some structure, a brighter core, and the stars are more concentrated, surrounded by a fainter halo, with the stars thin out. But to really appreciate the stellar beehive, you'll need at least a 6-inch, 150mm telescope. Then you can resolve, split apart M13's outer halo into hundreds of individual stars and even see starry sprinkles across the denser core. Using a magnification of someone who sees a cluster for the first time through a large telescope and a dark sky, while the visual and emotional impact of a planet is immediate, global clusters have this delicious built-in delay. There's a moment of silence followed by a second later by something along the lines of, "Oh my God, I can't believe all those stars." In these larger instruments, you can resolve most of the cluster and see one of the most striking features, tendrils of stars that extend from the core through the halo like crab legs. That's brilliant. If you can't afford bigger scopes, check and see if there's an astronomy club in the area. They'll be happy to share the sight. Seeing all those stars has you wondering what night sky would look like from the planet orbiting a star inside a globular cluster. Let's check it out. The average density of stars of a typical globular cluster is about 1 per light year. But in the standing room only core, that's close to 1 star per solar system diameter. From deep within the M13, you'd stare into the night sky spangled with thousands of stars, many times brighter than the brightest stars seen from Earth. They'd throw more light than a full moon, making finding your way at night a simple task, and cast multiple shadows overlapping shadows. On November the 16th, 1974, Frank Drake, the professor of astronomy at Cornell University, used the ARCO radio telescope in Puerto Rico to beam a signal postcard from Hercules to the Hercules cluster with the basic information about humans. It included our physical appearance and numbering system, the composition of DNA and graphic of our solar system, showing where the message came from. Consisting of 1,670 binary bits representing ones and zeros, it was the first deliberate effort in a modern era to toss a message in a bottle into the outer space and hope that an alien civilization might pick it up. And what better place than a rich, evolved star cluster that could potentially harbour tens of thousands of planets. The missive was barely out the door will have travelled 44 light years by 2018, only 0.02% of the way to the great cluster. But humming along at the speed of light, we appreciate the spirit and hope to propel it propelled it into the unknown. Okay, I'm feeling a bit tired now, but I've got to 3.3 slender moons. This is luck. Some people salivate over vintage cars. For me, the super thin lunar crescents, the more power to us both. My personal record of the youngest and thinnest crescent on the moon is 12.5 hours, and this was surprisingly easy to see. Nothing quite compares to the galaxy of the hours-old moon. Spider silk, maybe. Wiry moons magically bend into dissimilar shapes into one. Crescentic curves and two sharp points. Crescentic moons inhabit the western sky after sundown and the eastern sky before sunrise. Since we see them in the context of the most colourful times of day, they often take on a pink and orange hues of colour, which adds to their charm. Crescents, especially the thinnest, hover near the horizon and are only in view for a short time, like an all too brief visit from a good friend. It's hard to see the moon go, because the scene may not repeat itself for some time. Reminded how temporary so many things in life are. On the other hand, in the sight of fresh-faced lunar crescent reborn at dusk once the month may have the opposite effect and inspire you for a new purpose. Such is the wonder of nature that meaning is there for the taking. Like spotting a day-old moon isn't too difficult. Anything under 20 hours or 20 hours before the new moon, if you're seeking a morning crescent, takes careful planning. Every hour younger means the moon is much thinner and closer to the horizon, making it more difficult to see. You can see it just there with the minimum. The record for the youngest moon seen with the naked eye goes to the writer of an amateur astronomer, Stephen James O'Meara, who nabbed 15 hours and 13 minutes crescent on May 1990. More than G. Mercer of Tehran broke the record for the youngest moon ever seen with an optical aid in September 2002. He observed it from a mountain site using a giant 40 by 150 binoculars and kept the silver crescents in view for 1 minute. The moon had just 11 hours old and 40 minutes past the new on was 7.5 degrees from the sun. Could we do better? Probably not. In terms of seeing the moon with our eyeballs. But the ultimate record was set in July 2013 by a French astrophotographer Thierry Ragnon, who photographed the very moment the new moon that happened smack in the middle of the day, with the sun up and the sky blue. The moon lay south of the sun at the time, so the extreme northern edge caught enough sunrise sunshine to show the thinnest of crescents. He never saw it with his eye, only the camera recorded the historical moment. Believe it or not, we can repeat this feat. During a partial total solar eclipse, the new moon partially or completely blocks the sun. The black curve we see is a new moon. It's near sight, completely in shadow. We can cheat a little and call it a crescent, so thin you can never see it. Spring evenings and fall mornings are the best times for the crescent hunting. That's when straight up into the sky becomes easy to spot. In fall, ecliptic means the western horizon at shadow angle, and the moon barely clears the distant trees. Once you know the best viewing time, see next page. The rest, I hope, is easy. Cloud and cloud haze free sky with a wide open view of the west for evenings or at least the mornings. Oh, and bring binoculars. If the moon proves elusive to the naked eye, binoculars will help put it in. start looking around 20 to 30 minutes before the sunrise sunset, and before sunrise for those 20 to 24 hour old crescents. As you study the moon in binoculars, you'll notice right away the shiny arc isn't smooth, but it's rocketed and broken into segments. These seeming breaks are caused by oblique lighting of the crater walls and mountain peaks, and create shadows long enough even to bite in high portions of the moon's limb or edge. With the extremely heavy moons, the crater is shorter than normal and has a bended appearance. Oh, why do you say that? You might also notice the pale earth shine illuminating the remainder of the moon. We'll explore this more in detail in a separate entry, but know that what you're seeing is sunlight reflected twice, once for the earth on the moon and second time for the moon back to your eyes. Because it's reflected sunlight, it's not direct. It only faintly illuminates the non-sunlit portion of the moon. If you're lucky, a bright planet, usually Venus, will appear near the sunlit sliver and enhance the beauty of the scene. The moon in twilight is particularly shouts, "Take my picture." Sometimes you can handhold a camera because the modern lenses come with built-in stabilization. If you can't, then mount a camera on a tripod and compose the scene of the moon. Next, open your lens wide anywhere from f-stop 28 to f-stop 45 and set your ISO from 400 to 100, 800. Experiment with exposures for about a tenth of a second to several seconds long. Check the back display and adjust the exposure as needed because the crescent presents a sharp, bright shape. Your camera autofocus should work fine. If 24-hour whole old crescents prove too taxing, 48 ones are much easier to see and still thin enough to thrill. They're also visible for a longer time and shine brighter in the darker sky. Keep in mind the moon's exact age depends on your time zone. Example, a new moon occurs at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on March 15th. The moon will take 24 hours old at 8 p.m. the following evening, a perfect time to go out and look. How old will the moon be on the same evening at the same time zone? 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Standard Time is the same as 7 p.m. Central to Minnesotans must wait an additional hour for the sun to set, at which time the moon will be solder. I don't understand why you're bothering. A key to figuring out the moon's exact age is to consult the online calendar and find the time of the new moon. Then add hours or days until you arrive at the time you want to look for your thinnest crescent. So, if a new moon happens at 6 a.m. on April the 10th, you plan to observe it on the 11th at 9 p.m. The moon, that time, will be 1 day and 15 hours old. I wish you many dusks and dawns under the sickle moon. Okay, I finished reading that.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.